We've produced a new CD of two sermons preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin, one for Lent and one for Easter. And we'll send you this new CD for any size donation during the season of Lent. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or by check, Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. And for any size gift between now and April 12th, we'll send you a CD of one of Todd's Lent and Easter sermons.
There's no God who condones taking the life of an innocent human being. This much we know.
I think that it is a good time for those who voted for the ban against gay marriage to sit and reflect and anticipate their great shame and the shame in their grandchildren's eyes if they continue that way.
I feel that this happened for a much bigger reason than baseball. I think God's put me now in a forum where I can be heard, and I hope that kids would not make the same mistake that I made.
To all of the gay and lesbian kids out there tonight who have been told that they are less than by their churches, no matter what anyone tells you, God does love you. Very soon, I promise you, you will have equal rights federally across this great nation of ours.
You know, you just can't get away from it. No matter how much we try to redefine family through governmental policy, both local and federal, make the family a thing of the past or replace it with something else, some other institution, you just can't get away from it. A man and a woman make a child, and this makes a family. So since we're stuck with the institution, and I happen to think it's a very good institution, not one of human origin, since we're stuck with it, shouldn't good government be good to families? If it is the basic building block of our society, not only our society, but all society and civilization, shouldn't good government be good to and for the family? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in on this Monday, March the 2nd. After our conversation with Dr. Alan Carlson on family-friendly government policies, we'll explore some myths about death. Pastor Jared Melius will be our guest, author of an article titled Seven Most Popular Myths About Death. And then in the second hour of the program, it'll be Dr. Greg Beal of Wheaton College. He's author of a new book, The Erosion of Inerrancy in Evangelicalism. Can you believe it? That in evangelicalism, one of the foundational principles of evangelicalism, inerrancy, has been eroded. We'll talk about how it has in the second hour of the program on this Monday, March the 2nd. Dr. Alan Carlson is president of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society based in Rockford, Illinois, and he's author of The Natural Family, A Manifesto. Dr. Carlson, welcome back.
Pleased to be with you, Todd.
So how has government done so far in implementing family-friendly government policies here in the U.S.?
Well, the gold standard was the 1950s, when we really did have a very effective family policy. It happened partly by intent, partly by accident. Things went sour, went very bad in the 60s and 70s. There was some recovery in the 80s and 90s. The last good thing was the Bush tax cut of 2001, which was family-friendly. But since that time, not much. In fact, very little has been done. And we're nowhere near where we were in the 1950s.
Is there research that proves that what you call the natural family, two-parent families, are better for society as a whole?
Oh, the research is overwhelming. Thousands upon thousands of research studies in sociology, psychology, and so on reaffirm that, for example, children do best when they're raised with their two natural parents who are married. Any deviation from that, step-parents, single parenthood, gay parenthood, whatever you want to go, wherever way you go, the results for children are predictably worse. And also, the evidence is overwhelming that marriage between a man and a woman is good for both. The woman is will be healthier, wealthier, wiser, and safer. Men will be the same, healthier, wealthier, and wiser. And even for society, marriage makes good citizens. It grounds people down. Marriage and parenthood in particular reorient men to think about the future in a way that they wouldn't otherwise. They abandoned their bar-going, heavy-drinking ways, and they become responsible citizens and responsible workers. So the evidence is overwhelming. Marriage, parenthood are good for society.
What about from the children's perspective, the natural family and children? What have we seen by way of research there?
Again, the figures are quite overwhelming. A child growing up with its two natural parents will do much better in school, have higher IQ scores, will have much less likely to engage in destructive behaviors such as from cigarette smoking to heavy drinking to illegal drug use, much more likely to grow up safe and healthy and happy. Again, this is incontrovertible evidence. You can't be ignored, and there's really no debate on it anymore by anybody who honestly looks at the research.
What about children raised in the alternative? That is what is becoming so much more the norm, by and large, through the daylight hours, daycare, versus children who are raised at home with a parent.
Well, daycare particularly has a very negative influence, particularly when children are very young, between birth and age 2 or 3. Jay Belsky's research work, together with actually a huge federal project, looked at this, and there are significant problems. These kids have emotional problems. They actually are not good little group players in the future. In fact, they tend to be somewhat disruptive, much more self-centered. Again, there are some predictable problems there. Again, growing up with full-time parental care in the home is the best thing for children, particularly small children.
All right, then let's talk about a few specific areas of governmental policy where we could, it sounds like from your diagnosis so far, we could really use some improvement for both thinking of and implementing governmental policies that are family-friendly. Let's begin with the one that's most obvious nowadays, economic policy.
Well, what we need to do is to do a far better job of sheltering family income from taxation when children are in the home. Again, back in my golden age of the 1950s, the tax exemption for children was set at $500 per child. It doesn't sound like much, but when the median family income was about $3,000, a family of six was taken off the federal tax rolls by the exemption alone. They would pay no federal income tax. Right now the personal exemption is a figure. It's going to be around $3,500 this year. That's an improvement from the old figure. It's been going up and it's indexed to inflation, but it should be at least doubled. The other thing which needs to be done is the child tax credit, a separate tax credit keyed to family size. That's now at $1,000 per child. George Bush tax cut of 2001 fixed it at $1,000, but it hasn't. It's not indexed to inflation. It should be, and it's also not available for people at relatively upper incomes, although not as high as you might think. It's phased out for the upper end of the middle class, and it shouldn't be. It should be the phase out should be eliminated. Those would go a long way, again, to sheltering and protecting earned income of families while they have children in the home.
Is it, someone might say, look, if you, of course, you benefit one and you withdraw benefits from another, is family-friendly economic policy that you've described there in brief, is it in some way hostile toward what would be then the non-traditional family, single parents, any of those kind of things?
Not really. Again, it's the presence of a child in the household that gives the tax benefit. What is true is that, for example, single-parent families often tend to have much lower incomes. That's one of the problems with being a single-parent family. You just don't have the income. So they may not have as much tax liability. So they, in that sense, they would not benefit as much. With that said, though, there's no intentional discrimination against them. It's simply the way the process would work out.
How does government encourage marriage, or should government encourage marriage?
Well, it really should. Back again in the golden age of the 1950s, our federal tax system was based on a system called income splitting. It's complicated, but basically what it evolved into is that if you were married, your tax brackets were half as high as individuals then added back together. In a progressive tax system, without going into all the complicated details, that gave a real benefit to marriage. And it also reinforced the idea of having a parent at home, usually the mother, to care for children. There was, in some way, she became a tax shelter as well. And again, I think this was a very positive thing. It was a way of recognizing the work of a parent at home in the tax code and encouraging that kind of commitment when children are young and really do need that kind of care. So we had income splitting. It was a great system. Unfortunately, the federal government started to dismantle it in the late 1960s, creating the end result was to create what we now call the marriage penalty, and that still exists in the federal tax system. It's been relieved a little bit by recent tax reforms, but it's still there, and that needs to be eliminated. We need to go back to income splitting.
When we come back from this break, Dr. Alan Carlson will be with us for another 10 minutes. We're talking about family-friendly government policies this Monday, March the 2nd. Question I've got on my mind, should the government encourage bigger families, given the fact that we are beneath, at least if some statistics indicate that we are beneath replacement levels in our procreative activities in the United States, should the government find ways to encourage more children? We'll talk about that on the other side of the break. It's Monday, March the 2nd. Dr. Alan Carlson is our guest, president of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society based in Rockford, Illinois, author of The Natural Family, A Manifesto. In about 10 minutes, Pastor Jared Melius will join us. We'll discuss some myths about death. And then in the second hour of the program, Dr. Greg Beale of Wheaton College will join us. We'll talk about how inerrancy, the view of Scripture as inerrant, is going by the wayside with some evangelicals. Stay tuned. On behalf of the staff of Issues Etc., thanks to each and every one of the more than 7,600 who signed the online petition to bring back Issues Etc. Michelle Bennett, Pastor Edwin Rummerfield, Carol Rummerfield, Pastor Michael Nemec, Pat Stewart, Rob Moody, Dorothy Preuss, Donna Reed, David Bogda, and Charles Kennel. Thanks for your support.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Pro-life leader Dr. Lawrence White on why you should support Issues Etc.
In a culture that has forgotten about the truth of God, God's people need to stand upon His Word firmly and faithfully. Issues Etc. raises the questions that are in discussion in our society and in our church today, in a way that highlights the truth of God amid all the error and the falsehood of men. This is a program that is making a difference in our society, in our church, in our culture, to the glory of the Lord Jesus Christ.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a tax-deductible gift today. Donate online at issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check. Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Defending life from beginning to end. Issues, etc. Thanks for your support.
All right by me. We'll just add another limb to the family tree.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Dr. Alan Carlson is our guest. We're talking about family-friendly governmental policies. Monday, March the 2nd, I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Carlson, should the government make the case, if you're willing to, should the government encourage larger families?
Well, I think a large family is a sign of social responsibility, particularly one responsibly created, again, in a married couple that's not on welfare. Sure, government should favor larger families in that respect. It's good for the children. It's good for society. It's good for the country.
Okay, how is it good for it? I mean, talk in specific ways about how larger families are good today and in the future.
Well, it's first of all, it's a sign of self-confidence. When the United States, even going back to our colonial period, American fertility in the late 18th century at the time of the American Revolution was twice that of Europe. And our founding fathers, particularly Benjamin Franklin, recognized that this was actually a sign of health and of confidence in the future. And I think that's still true. Larger families tend to, I think, produce better children and better adults. They learn early on about how to cooperate, how to get along, how to share. They learn how to budget. Larger families tend to have to be a little more careful with their money. I think these, again, are all positive traits. Also, our country could use more people. The birth rate is really still, it's just barely at the replacement level. It's really still, I think, quite low by what I would call healthy historic standards.
I look at issues like, even something as touchy as abortion on demand policy, that what we've effectively done is truncated and culled not just one generation now, but we're going on two generations of Americans. And if you only look at that from the perspective of, say, Social Security, it paints a very bleak picture for the future of that policy.
Well, actually, that is entirely true. And I'm glad you actually raised Social Security. Actually, there's a solution to the problem of Social Security. It's to raise the total fertility rate of the United States from 2.1 to about 2.6 or 2.7. Again, we're not talking about families of 20 children here. We just get the average American family up a little closer to 3 from 2 right now. And the Social Security problem vanishes. Not only will you not have to raise taxes, but there will, in fact, be a fairly healthy surplus in that system. Oddly enough, this is the one solution that no politician seems to think about or talk about. I find that kind of odd because it's kind of the happiest solution.
I mean, have children, plan for your future, and let your children help you with your future. It seems like kind of the way before Social Security. It seems the way that Americans, before we had a concept of retirement, how they planned for that retirement.
Well, indeed, it was. That is the historic way. And the issue of relative Social Security gets kind of complicated if you look at it too deeply, because there are some ways in which having too large of a Social Security system actually indirectly encourages small families or childlessness. But I think right now the government policy should use tax policy and other housing policy to encourage larger families. I think it's the solution to our most pressing public policy problem today, which is how do we pay for Social Security and Medicare.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about housing, especially given the fact that the economic crisis that we face has been deeply related to at least lending policy when it comes to housing. How can we improve housing policy in the U.S. to benefit the family?
Well, there again, in the golden age of the 50s, the system of housing support and subsidy worked very well. Almost 99% of federally backed guaranteed loans through the VA and FHA programs went to young married couples just starting out. The default rate on those loans was extremely low. It was under 1%. And the system worked really well because its focus was mainly on families. It was trying to get young families in households. The problem with federal supports there, including federal insurance for home mortgages, tax deductibility for home mortgages, and certain other encouragements and incentives, is that at some point, probably in the late 60s, early 70s, housing, the goal was no longer a good house and a good home for a family, but it became much more of a speculation. That is, house became a vehicle of investment rather than a place to live.
Hmm.
And that there was a tendency to, as they call it, trade up. And that, I think, was a mistake. I think we lost our bearings. The federal government has no business in encouraging housing as an investment, as opposed to other forms of capital investment. In fact, we're probably overinvested in housing stock in this country, grossly overinvested. But part of what we do have is a vested interest is encouraging families. So the way to solve that, for example, would be to cap the deductibility of mortgages at a certain amount of money. Say the mortgage on a house above $250,000 would no longer be deductible. And that would encourage, again, I think, not speculation in McMansions. We've got these huge, empty 40-room houses out in the suburbs where one or two people live, just because of speculation. Encouraging instead a refocus of federal housing and the real benefit that's there on younger families.
Okay, so it sounds like you're saying things were very good when it was governmental policy to encourage young families to have a place to live that they would eventually own outright.
That's right. And that was the idea.
When people started saying, you know, this house is a pretty good investment, I'd like to treat it like any other investment and stop thinking of it as my permanent place to live or my semi-permanent place to live that I'll eventually own outright, then the government encouraging that was essentially then undermining the housing policies that were good for the family.
I think that's exactly right. The other thing the federal government did in the late 60s and early 70s very consciously was to say, well, we're not going to be giving any favoritism to young families anymore. We want to start helping and giving financial encouragement and support to non-traditional families. And they very consciously set out to do this. And there's even some evidence, in fact, I think some very good evidence that economists have shown, that the government started to, its housing policy in some ways even encouraged divorce by making it easier for a divorced couple to have two homes instead of one. And so there's some odd ways in which federal policy and housing encouraged family breakup rather than family togetherness.
Well, then let's deal with divorce with about a minute and a half before our time winds down. What was the biggest mistake the government has made in recent history with regard to its policies or its laws concerning divorce that has hurt the family?
Well, I think without question the biggest mistake was the no-fault divorce revolution, which initiated in the late 60s. The promise was that this would reduce the antagonism in divorce and make divorce a little more pleasant, less conflicting. But in abandoning a fault-based system, fundamentally changed the nature of divorce. When you had fault-based divorce, marriage was treated as a public good, and divorce was treated as something kind of like a crime. That is, you were committing a crime against the public good. You were the public good being the preservation of an intact home, which is good for children. And I like that theory. I think it was a terrific one. And also, no-fault divorce, instead of just being neutral in terms of numbers of divorce, there's actually quite good evidence that, in fact, it encouraged, independent of all other factors, encouraged divorce. The end result, though, has not been more pleasant divorces. It's actually the conflicts have simply shifted to other things, like child custody in particular. So divorces are just as every bit as nasty as they were in the old days. But right now, the public policy, again, has made divorce much easier. And in fact, what divorce law should do is encourage make, be difficult so that couples are under strong incentives to try to solve their problem before returning to the divorce court. Solve their problem and stay out of the divorce.
Then with only 30 seconds, make the case, why should good government encourage policies that are good for the family?
Well, the alternative is just a skyrocketing welfare state. When families fail in great numbers, when they fail to form or when they break apart, the end result is ever accelerating imposition of costs on the central government and on state governments. a fiscal crisis of great enormity. It's one of the reasons our government is effectively or getting approached close to bankruptcy right now.
Folks, you'll find a link to the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society under the on-demand page of our website, issuesetc.org. Dr. Alan Carlson is president of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society based in Rockford, Illinois, and author of The Natural Family, A Manifesto. Dr. Carlson, it's always a pleasure, very informative. Thank you for being our guest.
Well, I've enjoyed it.
Think about it this way. We've talked about economic failure. We've talked about a collapse in the United States and one that we are still facing, probably the downward slope of. Think about it this way. Ask yourself this question and then think about it in terms of how you will vote in the future regarding your family and a family-friendly government. To what degree has the collapse and the failure been a failure of families, government's failure of the family, and its failure to encourage, to support, and to keep the family, the natural family, at the center of its policies? Think about that. It's not just an economic collapse. Perhaps it is a collapse of the family as well. When we come back from this break, we'll talk about myths regarding death. Pastor Jared Melius will be our guest. And then in hour two, is the inerrancy of Scripture still holding strong in evangelicalism? Dr. Greg Beal of Wheaton College will answer that question. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk with Dr. Ken Sherb about President Gerald Kishnick's Blue Ribbon Task Force on Synod Structure and Governance. We'll be right back.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Have you heard of the CLCC? In Hosea 4, we see, "My people are destroyed by lack of knowledge." The Confessional Lutherans for Christ's Commission can help educate Lutherans on being Lutheran. We treasure our Lutheran beliefs and think that all Lutherans would if they learn what we believe, teach, and confess. Visit our website, www.theclcc.org. Check out what we have to offer. Get on our mailing list, or better yet, join us. And maybe encourage your pastors or lay leaders to hold a seminar in your area. Go to theclcc.org.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
Last week, I told you about a woman in China who was being forced to abort her third child late in pregnancy due to their brutal population control policy. She was forced to turn herself in at the local hospital. At one point, she literally escaped but was captured and returned to the facility. Two pro-life congressmen, Chris Smith and Joe Pitts, got involved. Working with the Bush administration, they gave her dire situation international attention. The Chinese government was concerned the truth about their barbaric practice, which has already killed tens of millions of babies, would further tarnish their image. So officials released the pregnant hostage, saying she wasn't in good enough health to have an abortion. Our thanks to these American leaders who spoke out.
For more information, visit our website at lifeissues.org and stay informed. More informed than you've ever been.
On behalf of the staff of Issues Etc., thanks to each and every one of the more than 7,600 who signed the online petition to bring back Issues Etc. John, Pastor Greg Truey, Jim Kabitsky, Chris Orman, James Garnett, Mary Hackett, Timothy Kautz, Tim Curry, Jeff Tupper, and Kelly Vetriti. Thanks for your support.